Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, Taoiseach Simon Harris has pledged that the practice of rape victims' counselling notes being used in criminal trials will be stopped. The issue was raised following the launch of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre's annual report, where Justice Minister Helen McEntee said she wants the situation changed and doesn't want this to be a feature in court cases. Well, one woman who faced this very issue is Paula Doyle, and she joined me in the studio earlier this week to share her story. A warning that some listeners may find this conversation distressing. I started by asking Paula to tell me more about her life before she was assaulted in 2019.
Yeah, okay. My name is Paula and I'm a 51-year-old woman, but I'm also a daughter, a sister, a friend, a work colleague, but most importantly a mum. I just feel like a normal, everyday woman.
Mm-hmm.
We had a busy, bustling house. Five children, it's very busy. They arranged that it was teenagers, but I also had a very young little girl who was only five at the time.
Yeah, so a very typical life and a very normal life.
Very normal, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then we'll talk a little bit about what happened. And I know you were at a social gathering at a house of somebody that you knew, and you were leaving there and you were planning to walk home, weren't you, to
yes.
Your own house?
Yeah.
Will you tell us, as far as you're comfortable, what happened next?
Okay, it's about a 5-7 minute walk. And I was leaving. My friend asked her husband to accompany me home, which I didn't agree with, but it was easier at the time then to end up giving in rather than and go with it. The journey home, I did say a couple of times, it's okay now, I'm fine here. And we got to the park and I left him the far side of the gate. I continued on in the park, and then when I came round, when I woke up, I was being raped.
Before he attacked you, he was talking to you about his own problems, wasn't he? And was he asking you to intervene in his own marital issues?
He was asking me to try and help with his marital problems and fix things and speak to people, in-laws, speak to his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just something that I wasn't going to do. I hadn't spoken to this person for over 5 years anyway. And it wasn't something that I was comfortable with doing.
And you told him that very clearly.
I did say to him that if he wants to talk to these people, it's better coming from himself.
Mm-hmm. And he attacked you. You, as you said, then you came around and you were being raped by this man.
Yes. Yeah.
What happened then?
When I was left there, just like a piece of rubbish, when he was finished, I made my way home. A lot of that weekend is quite blurry.
This was on a Friday night, wasn't
it? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's. I just tried to get on with the weekend of busy soccer matches, etc. But I also hid myself away from my family for the weekend, which is really not like me, and it's difficult to do when you have five kids. So I wasn't a very nice person that weekend.
But you didn't tell anybody because, and I think a lot of people can understand this, you just wanted things to get on, to be normal, to be a normal weekend, and for this thing that had happened to you to go away.
Well, I also knew that how many lives would be shattered and affected by this.
Yeah.
So I thought, if I just bury this and put this in a big box and be a strong woman and just put it away, I can deal with this and just get rid of it. And nobody needs to know, because I knew how other people would be affected by this, and not only me. I am a mam that I had to think of not only my own life, but other people's lives.
Mm-hmm. When did that change then? At what stage?
It changed on the Monday that I knew I couldn't, even with the busyness of school and lunches and et cetera and work, et cetera. I knew I couldn't keep going on with this, that I was just actually going to either do something to myself or explode. And I knew I couldn't go on. So I went to visit a friend and told a friend and one of my best friends and her husband.
And what did they advise you to do, or what ended up happening?
They were fantastic. They were in complete shock too, obviously. But they just sat with me and they just let me talk. They let me cry. They let me curl into a ball in the room. They couldn't advise me really on anything because it was nothing like we had all experienced before. So they did put the number of SATU, Assault Treatment Unit, into my phone. They did advise me to go to the guards, but at the time I still wasn't. I just wanted to be able to tell somebody. I didn't know what I was going to do because although he had attacked me, I hadn't cleared in my head actually what had happened. I was still trying to process this.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, there's no right or wrong way to behave after you have been raped. There's no textbook to say, this is what you should do. Mm-hmm. This is, you should go straight to the Garda station. There's nothing to tell. You know, you're a human being.
Well, nothing makes sense, I would imagine, in that moment, right?
Yeah. No, nothing. You're just trying to cope, really.
But you did make the decision to report it, didn't you?
I did. I left, and then I left my home. I didn't know where I was going or what I was doing. And I rang SATU, and I spoke to a beautiful lady. She kept me on the phone for a while. She was quite worried about my mental health. She made an appointment for me to come and see. She asked me for my injuries, and she made an appointment for me to come in later on. Mm-hmm. But she asked me, would I just, because I was quite near to Blanchetown Village, would I just walk to the Garda station and ring me from there and let me know that she's okay, that I was okay. And so once I got in there, I asked for a female guard because they could see I was in quite a bad state by the time I got there. And that's when I told them what had happened.
So you made your formal report, then you went to the sexual assault treatment unit.
Yeah.
And it all started, the process started from
the
from
long
there.
Process started from there, yeah.
And the Gardaí came to your house then to take the formal statement, I know. And I mean, this is just unfathomable because it was during that process that you discovered that your attacker was the same person that had been stalking you.
Yes.
Will you talk us through how that realisation dawned on both you and the guard who was there in the house?
The guards were wonderful that they would come to my house and take the statements, and we just did it in segments because this had to be a very carefully done but long process, and it took several hours per day. So on the Thursday, so my phone was on the table, vibrating, on silent but still vibrating. And the detective that was there had said, Paula, we need to take this so carefully. Do you mind if we just, I know you're worried about the children. Do you mind if we just put the phone in another room? You can put it on, but just so that we can hear you properly and get every word exactly what you're saying. I said, absolutely. She made a joke saying, oh, you know, you're very popular, all these messages coming in. And I just said, oh, it's just pest calls, pest texts I'm getting. I've been getting them for a few years now. I couldn't even remember the amount of time. And the number was blocked on my phone, but it still vibrates to let you know that you're getting messages. She asked, could she see my phone? I handed my phone over. We continued on with the interview, taking my statement. And she then asked me for the address of the alleged perpetrator of the attack. I gave her the address. And she just said, I'm so sorry. And she turned the phone around, and there on the location, there was a red dot beeping. And that was the location of the person that was sending the text. And it was also his home address.
Were you floored?
At first, it didn't sink in. She just said, we'll stop for a minute. And the guard beside her was floored. I just didn't really understand because I'd never seen anything like this before. I didn't understand the technology of what it was. So she actually had to say to me, Paula, this is the person that's been sending you the text messages. But as she had the phone in her hand, the phone was still beeping again. So more messages were coming in. Mm. I was not floored. I was violently sick. We stopped there and then because I wasn't in a good place. to know that this had been happening. It ended up in nearly 3.5 years. I didn't realise it was so long. Now, we had reported it to the guards, and myself and my partner had gone to the guard station about them. But at the time, this was 2016, 2017, 2018, the stalking laws hadn't come in, so they couldn't do anything. They just said, keep the messages if anything happens, if anyone enters your property. But sure, I didn't know who it was to enter my property. You know.
And you had gone to a lot of rounds, I know, because I've read about this, you went to a lot of rounds to try and figure out who that was, and your friends were helping you, and it was a mystery.
Everybody knew about it. I didn't hide.
Yeah, everyone knew that you were getting these awful messages to your phone.
Yeah,
I mean, you'd been through an awful lot really before the attack, because the impact of that's frightening stuff.
You know, and that's what I was saying, that although the trial has taken 4.5 years to get here, I had 3.5 years before that. So I've had 8 years of this. Mm. You know, that your life, my life beforehand was kind of keeping an eye out and kind of watching people, closing the curtains extra. I wouldn't go out the front to put something out in the bin at night time. I should have been okay, but I just kind of always felt a little bit nervous.
But these messages were telling you that you were being watched.
Yes.
And you were being watched. You know that now.
Yeah, no, yes. But I also know that because it came out of who it was and who I was with, although I was being watched, it was... It was just constant that because it became every day, it's nearly part of your life. Mm. That when you arrive somewhere, you're looking around to check out, you have no face to this person. So you can't say, oh, you know, could be that person, that could be that person. If I would get a text when we were out, myself and my friends would go around and take turns ringing the number and to see, would anybody's phone vibrate on the table? You know, would anybody, we would just try to ring it, unblock it on my phone, or they would ring it, put their numbers on private and ring it and see, walk around and see, mm-hmm. where's this person? Who is it?
And clearly he wasn't using his normal phone and his normal number to send these messages. So you made the statement, he was charged. It was 4.5 years then, I know, Paula, before he was found guilty. And you've described in part how hard that was. But you talk about, which I think, you know, anyone who understands what this must be like will find this really difficult to hear. But you really struggled with physical contact with the people that you love, even with your own children. Can you describe that to me?
I suppose it's going to be weird, maybe, as... for listeners that are mums themselves, and as a mother and not wanting to hug your children. I couldn't. I was so, even after you get the all clear from SATU, like you haven't caught HIV, which takes some months to get through, even though you're given the all clear that your body is clean. That's the word they use. You still don't feel clean. You feel contaminated and you feel vile. And your skin doesn't actually feel like your own. I had gone to my doctor and I pleaded with my doctor if I could just have a blood transfusion, if I could get everything that was inside me out. I didn't understand how that would work, but that's how I was feeling. My children, I couldn't hug them. I couldn't, even if they had got great results in a junior cert, I couldn't give them a hug and say, well done. I couldn't give my little girl a hug if she fell and hurt her knee. I would just give her a thumbs up and say, it's going to be okay soon. They invented air hugs in my family. And that's even when I would allow them close enough to give an air hug, or they would blow a kiss goodnight. I'm so fortunate they still could do that. And that was their own invention. But I couldn't put my defiled body against their innocent body of my children. It's just something that I couldn't. It's not that I physically didn't want to be close to them. My heart ached just to hold them and have a hug.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that to them. I couldn't put what was on me on them.
Has that changed for you now?
Some nights. I have good days and bad days. If I'm not having such a good day, we will do hugs, because I have promised them so many squeezy hugs. I have a lot of years to make up for. But it's like, even with my partner, if I was at home and he would come behind me, I was at the sink and he'd go to give me a hug, I would be triggered. I would, like, even in queues at a shop, I can't queue in a shop or I can't be anywhere if we were to go out somewhere, which was very rare. But I realised their life had to go on. We were having 24s, we were having, not parties, but we would go out for a meal. I'd have to sit with my back to a wall just to make sure there's nobody behind me.
I talked about the process then of waiting for the 4.5 years between the charges and the guilty result. But there were a number of aspects, Paul, I know, of the criminal justice system that you found particularly difficult, that you wanted to talk about. And the reason you want to talk about them is that you're hoping that things might change, because these things you found increased your trauma. So will you talk us through some of those things?
I suppose my own personal experience of going to trial, it feels inhumane and it feels incomprehensible, because you haven't got a chance to heal when you're waiting for this to happen. You're just surviving every day, and sometimes your daily life is hanging by a thread and people are saying, you know, it's okay, I'll ring you at 3 o'clock. This could be 10 o'clock. And you're saying, I don't think I'll get till 11. You know, so you're not sure how you're going to survive hourly, never mind daily. The nightmares would start during the night. Some nights I would sit up and just be ready, because in my head you're so extreme paranoia, extreme alertness, and your brain, people are telling you it's not going to happen, nothing's going to happen, but your brain isn't working. You can't fathom that something that already happened, that you were told in text messages was going to happen. You can't fathom that something else isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
You're not thinking rationally. Mm-hmm. And for me at the time, people would say they'd ring me, but your future, you're just existing, your future doesn't matter. You can't think of the future. You can't think of, even though you're given a date, you can't think of how, you know, you're thinking, how am I going to get there? How am I going to survive? You're just, every strength you're using.
So this is all a symptom of the wait, the long wait to have this play out in court. You feel that that is having such a negative impact on someone like you, who is being asked to stick with this process, you know, and there is an option not to stick with it. You know, you can withdraw from this.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure that's tempting, isn't it?
Absolutely. So many times I went down to the Garda station and said, listen, I'm sorry, I cannot do this. I cannot go on for myself, for my family. Like, the ripple effects on a family and friends is just, it's enormous.
Mm-hmm.
They pleaded with me and they said, Paula, please, you know, just keep going. We're so nearly there. They did apologise that they couldn't give me any answers. You know, after our forced adjournment, I was told that even though we had that date 2 years previous, I was told then in our forced adjournment that there was not enough courtrooms, there wasn't enough judges. But the government have said they're making changes, that they have, you know, extra judges, they're trying to speed up the process. But I had 2 adjournments.
Mm-hmm. And the impact of that is profound, as you've explained.
Yeah.
Now, you did give evidence in the trial by video link,
yeah,
but you were supported to do that. That's not available to everybody, is
no.
it?
I call myself a lucky victim, which might seem a bit strange, but I have been blessed with, over the past number of years, finding some very good lifesavers, and my counsellor would be one of my lifesavers from the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. My family and a couple of close friends and my children. And you have to be psychologically assessed for either a video link or a screen, and that is done at the preliminary hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I had to prove that there was actually something wrong with me. Of course, there's something wrong with me. You know, you only had to look at me every day. I was a shell of myself,
yeah,
what I used to be.
So do you believe that should be an automatic right for an alleged victim to be able to give their evidence either behind a screen if that's what they choose, or via video link if that's what they choose?
Absolutely. For my court accompaniment, which again was provided by the DRCC, and she was fantastic. And she brought me into the courtroom a few months before my first date. and she had shown me where I would be sitting, and she would showed me where he would be sitting, which is maybe 6 foot to my right hand side. There was no way. I knew straight away there was no way I was going to be able to do that.
Yeah.
As it was, I was sick in the courtroom, physically sick. I knew his smell, a movement of a hand, a look. I think it's absolutely appalling. It's horrific to expect a victim that has been through such an appalling attack to be able to sit there with the person so close. There's nobody else that's closer to you except the attacker.
Yeah. The other issue I know you found really difficult, and you mentioned the counselling that you went through, is the fact that the perpetrator can request and be given access to your counselling notes.
Yeah. Yeah, the DPP requested my counselling notes 5 months before my original date. That again is served to you in a brown envelope from the guards. These are private. It was over 3 years of counselling notes originally. Distressing notes to be scrutinised by the prosecution, the defence, for any slight bit of evidence that could be used against me in a case. I just felt, can a victim not hold on to one minimalistic piece of themselves? Like, I had talked about how this affected me, how it affected my family, friends, what it was doing to me, how I had tried to take my own life. And even the more sickening thing is that the person that has done this also gets to read my notes.
Yeah.
It's perverse. It's actually disgusting and twisted. And I suppose it feels like, for me, it felt like nearly a second violation, that he had taken my body, now he was taking my mind and my soul, what I had bared my soul in counselling.
And you have written, I know, to the Minister for Justice, haven't you?
I have, about
this.
Yeah. But it's just this time, when you've gone all through all you have and they're looking for your counselling notes, it's actually been supervised by the courts and the justice system, that they are saying, yeah, no, this is okay. Hand over the notes. You know, they're agreeing that this should be done.
It's an incredibly difficult position for you to be in, to know that they're part of the case, part of his defence.
Well, they are helping.
Yeah.
You know, and so many survivors have called for this over the past number of years, and it's still there. It's still happening. It's still happening on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I did write to, when I had my second adjournment last July, I wrote to the Minister for Justice. I also wrote to other female TDs of leading opposition parties. It was a very emotive email, very long email. I knew things weren't going to change for me, but I was pleading with them to highlight this, to bring this forward, to make people coming after me, because I didn't know if I would survive this, people coming after me, that to make it that they didn't have to go through what I did, and that let them know how flawed the system was. Like, are they even aware of how flawed the system is and how damaging? You know, you've no chance to heal. That time when I was, because you have to go through your counselling notes then to make sure everything is accurate, and so you're reading what you have gone through again, you're reliving it, and it's just, this is the time that I should be using to try and heal myself. And your hour counselling of every week has been taken off now, gone through notes.
Yes. To verify them, to sign them so that you can hand them over. You talk about women coming after you and that the experience might be hopefully improved for them. Is that the reason why you've decided to speak out about this? Is it so that the system might be changed, or is it to help you and to help your family with your recovery? What is your main aim, Paula, now?
I suppose my main aim is that I have children. I have 3 boys and 2 girls. And I want the next generation. I want this country to be a safer place. But I also want our judicial system to change. As I said already, so many people have pleaded time and time again. And, you know, and so many courageous men and women have come out over the past number of years, but also over the past couple of weeks. I feel we're just another statistic, just a headline. It's Blonid's headline this week. It's Natasha's headline. People are appalled, but we need people. We need the public behind us, and we need people like yourself, Claire. to show that this isn't right, that taking a person's counselling records, like if he received counselling over the 4.5 years, they cannot be requested. Where is the justice in that?
Mm. Well, I'm conscious that there may be women listening to this who are in a similar situation, may have been through something just like this and are feeling the way you did over that weekend. What do you say to them, having experienced the system?
Well, look at me. You know, I've got there. You're not alone. There is others like you out there. I know it's difficult to take every day and I'm talking about it, but you're not isolated in the feelings that you're having. And it's not going to be everlasting. Although it is a deplorable and a long journey that you're on, it will end. You will not be silenced forever and your voice will be heard. You will get there and you won't always feel alone. And I suppose for me now, you know, I have hope. I did say I have good and bad days, but I am getting better. And this is my chance to heal. But I do think that the person that's alone now is the person that attacked me that was found guilty. And he is the one that's sitting alone in his cell at night now. And when he closes his eyes, he's the one that's alone. Mm. And I'm the one that has my family and friends around me and my life. And I will get my life back.
And you got great support, I know, from the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, yeah, who you've mentioned a number of times. But they were invaluable to you right throughout.
Absolutely. They become like nearly a second family. That it's I cannot, like, my counsellor was there. I'll never be able to thank the DRCC for giving me my life, you know, and now my children still have a mammy here with,
yeah,
them.
And you mentioned your family, your friends and your partner who's helped you get through all of this as well. But don't underestimate what you're doing in speaking out, because it is only when people like you speak out that it prompts the next person to do so, that it prompts the next person to report a crime and to get the support that they need. And that's huge.
Yeah, no, it is. But I have some strong, courageous women to look back on, who gave me the courage, mm-hmm, you know, for me to actually say. And I said, if I got through this trial, I was going to stand on those steps. And if I got the verdict that I deserved, I was going to stand on those steps. And that day I wanted to sing actually from the roof, because it's just such an enormous weight, enormous, like the jury in my case. I'll never meet them 11 people again. But I can never thank them enough for giving me my life back.
Well, Paul, it's been a pleasure to meet you and an honour to meet you. And thank you very much for talking to us.
Thanks so much, Claire.
And that was Paula Doyle. And I just want to thank her again for her bravery in telling that story. It wasn't easy for her and she did it, as you heard there, to help others. And if you've been affected by anything that you've just heard, you can call the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre on their free phone 24-hour national helpline number. It's 1-800-77-88-88. You can find out more information about helplines by visiting rte.ie/helplines.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.